Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Hello, welcome to Tiny Revolutions. I'm Tiff Stevenson, and I'm talking to some of your favourite creators, comedians, authors, musicians about what their tiny revolutions are. This week on the podcast, he's the daddy. He's the podfather himself. Put your hands together. And when I say put your hands together, I mainly just mean me and the guest. For the fantastic Andy Saltzman. Woo!
Hello, Tiff.
Hello.
Did you mean put your hands together as in, you know, pray? Or do you have to put your hands together, then take them apart and put them together again in quick succession as you just did? Slightly.
Yes, okay. The latter. All right. The latter. Although I could pray to you.
But well, why not? There have been stranger gods in human history.
And I did refer to you as the Podfather.
Exactly.
Which I believe you are. And we'll get into more of that. You've been a tiny revolution to me. So everyone that's done the podcast thus far has been a tiny revolution to me. And I'll tell you why you've been a tiny revolution. I've seen your shows up in Edinburgh over the years, and you're pretty much maybe the only person that can make me laugh at a pun. Which I think is a skill because of the lengths that you will go to crowbar something so silly and so funny into a pun. I absolutely love it. And I can only have Saltzman puns. If anyone else tries, I want to hit them. And yeah, I love the surreal silliness of seeing your shows up at the Fringe. I remember actually one year, I think it was Daniel Kitson, we did a lineup show together. It might have been about 2007 or 2006. And it was the very last night of the Fringe. It might have been the BBC Presents, and Daniel Kitson was handing out flyers for your run.
All right.
On the last day, and heckling and interrupting you, which is a very good introduction to Andy Saltzman. So before we get into Edinburgh and all of those other things, the first question I have is basically becoming, not to sound too Red Dragon about it, do you see? But was this design or happy accident? That you are Andy Saltzman, satirist, comedian. How did this happen? Was this meant to be?
I've no idea, to be honest, Tiff. I mean, it did happen largely by accident, in that I hadn't really thought of comedy as a career until after I'd started doing it. So I was always interested in it, and I guess through my... I mean, I had a school report when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11, saying... this child has no sense of humour and needs to lighten up, essentially. So maybe I took that on board slightly too much and now I find it hard to take anything seriously. So, yes, it wasn't... I mean, as a youngster, my ambition was to be a cricket journalist, and I've ended up becoming, you know, working in cricket via comedy. So I think that's more what I'd sort of imagined myself being when I was young, and comedy, you know, I've made people laugh increasingly during school and then university, but I didn't really think of it as a potential career, particularly not after when I left university, I went to the Edinburgh Festival, mostly just to watch a few things. And I did three open mic spots, having done a few shows in a nice, cosy university venue. And my first three open mic spots at the Edinburgh Festival went so badly that I gave up and thought, well, that's that then. I'm never going to do that again. And it was about 18 months before I then started doing the open mic circuit in London. So I'm not sure it was... as a youngster, I'd never sort of pictured myself as a professional comedian. But I'm not sure I really knew that was an option either.
A straight statistician.
Yes.
Is that how you say it?
Statistician. Well, yeah, I mean,
statistician.
I listened to cricket commentary on the radio from when I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old. And always loved the statistics. My dad gave me a book which had a load of kind of charts and scorecards in the back when I was 7 years old. And so... So, I mean, that was more of a likely career to me than comedy, I think.
You grew up in a creative household because your dad's a sculptor, right?
Yes. Yes, he was a sculptor. He recently stopped doing it at the age of 79. But, yes, yeah, so he, you know, just had a studio, basically an old converted farm building. And so I guess there was a role model in our lives for... three of us. We have an elder brother, Richard, and Helen, the famous, notorious podcaster and occasional bugle guest, who is younger than me by about 5 years. And so we grew up without a sort of regular kind of standard career role model from our father, who, you know, disappeared off to his studio and made sculptures and then came back in the evening.
He literally created something out of nothing.
Yes. Well, he created
something. It's an idea.
Yes.
And then he sculpts and creates.
Yes, out of wax and metal and plaster of Paris.
Yes.
And things like that. So, yes, I guess we didn't grow up thinking, you know, there's certain careers that we should be doing. So I guess that gave us a blank canvas and almost a pattern, not really a sort of pattern to follow, but there was no sort of strictures on what we could what we could think of as a way to live a life.
There was no sitting down and saying, Andy, you've got to get serious now. What are you going to do as a job?
Yes,
you need a 9 to 5.
Yes, that's a conversation that I've never had. So that was a fairly formative part of our childhoods growing up with a father who didn't do a regular job.
And also because he's in the process of creativity and his work being sort of received, I guess this is a very early entry into what it's like to create something and then have it critiqued. Do you remember any of that or not really? You just remember the...
Yeah, I mean, he didn't sort of have that many exhibitions or anything. There were sort of occasional sporadic sales, but that wasn't really part of it. I guess the element of the creative lifestyle was that, you know, that sort of difficulty of, you know, selling stuff, I guess, of, you know, that there's more to creativity than just making stuff. And, you know, there's, a necessity to... try and build a career around it, which maybe is something that our father didn't concentrate on quite as much as he could have done. He made all these beautiful things, and they mostly ended up in our house, so it was a lovely place to grow up in.
So monetizing, because that was one of the things that my parents had, because my dad was in a band, but he also worked in management and stuff like that. So my family were a bit more like, there isn't really money to be made here. This is the fun stuff. Even though my aunt was an actress, but it was seen as a bit of a frivolity, like a bit of a, this is a bit of frippery. This isn't really what you do. So I'm interested in that because I do think that's a thing that comedians butt heads against quite a lot, is the idea of creating something, then being able to monetize it and then it becoming a career. So the reason I ask that is because no one ever really expects to have a career in stand-up comedy. I didn't,
yes.
Certainly.
And I don't know if that's changed in the last, yeah, 15 years since, or well, 20 years since I started doing it, and I think it has become more of a visible, viable career option for people starting out in a way that I'm not sure it was to the same extent when we were starting our sort of fumbling around the open mic circuit.
Furtive fumblings of the open yes. mic circuit. Well, that sounds a bit description. Dodgy, doesn't
it? But when I left university, I didn't really have a career plan, and maybe that was a further legacy of what our father had done for his job. I'd not really thought, what do I do next? How do I go about building a career? So, I worked unsatisfactorily and unhappily for a year as a sub-editor for a business publishing firm, which was even less exciting than it sounds. And then started doing the open mic circuit and was, I guess, doing well enough within a few months. Some made it to a couple, sort of one of the open mic finals in the competitions in Edinburgh, and then started getting offered a few paid gigs. So I started thinking, well, maybe this can be a career. But it
an actual thing.
Largely accidental, to be honest.
Considering the type of comedian you are now, for me, this is an interesting question, and I was keen to sort of speak to Armando about this as well. What is your earliest political memory? And were your family massively political growing up and engaged with politics? Or was that something you found yourself?
I think I found it late, to be honest. I grew up in Tunbridge Wells, which was about the most conservative place that you can grow up in the 1980s. So, and went to a private boys' school. So it was about as Tory an upbringing as you could have. So I don't think I really contemplated politics to any great degree until probably sometime after I'd gone to university. I guess the 97 election, so that would have been my last year at university when, for the first time in my conscious life, the Conservatives didn't win. That I guess I'd started getting more interested in it. But I was interested in political comedy from what I'd seen on television and also to an extent what I studied at university when I studied ancient Greek comedy as part of my degree, which was
you did the classics, right?
Yes, yeah, and
so you can do anything. You can be prime minister now, Andy.
Absolutely, yes.
That's how that works.
I mean, I should be prime minister in that I have an essentially pointless degree from Oxford. I've never had a proper job, and I have no qualifications for being prime minister, which makes me an ideal candidate for being prime minister. Well, I don't think I have quite the same level of undisclosed children, so maybe that's what's holding me back. But so I studied the comedies of Aristophanes, who wrote these really kind of political, satirical comedies in the late 5th century BC in Athens, and they were absolutely fascinating, sort of total comedy that had a mixture of dick jokes and puns and fart jokes and high-end political satire and literary parody. They were performed to the entire adult male non-slave population of Athens at the time, so they had to appeal on numerous levels. So that was I loved and you mentioned Armando. I did the day to day. That was a bit of a turning point for me in my comedy watching career. And I chanced upon an episode of the day to day on television late one night and was just blown away by the brilliance and the inventiveness of it. And so I guess that was would have been again when I was at university. I guess by the end of my time at university, I'd started to think more about politics. I wouldn't say I was particularly involved in it, but to think about politics broadly and to think about how politics works in comedy.
So some of those early Tiny Revolutions were the day to day. Were you into The Young Ones? What else were you watching?
I can't really remember. I got into Monty Python. A moment for me that I remember quite clearly. My first exposure to Monty Python about the age of 15 was seeing The Holy Grail, and that really got me on a sort of comedic soul level. So then after that I started, and it was a bit harder to get hold of it. They used to show repeats every now and again on television, and I'd record them on a little VHS tape.
And then go, don't record over this with a football or the... Well, you probably wouldn't mind the football being recorded over it. That's what happened to mine.
Yeah, we had lots of videos with Monty Python, and a mixture of Monty Python and cricket highlights on. Clutter up our living room. I'm trying to think of the sort of little kind of, I guess, light bulb moments in you know, me watching comedy. I guess my first experience of Monty Python, then seeing the day-to-day, and in terms of stand-up, that came a bit later once I'd already started doing stand-up, and I saw Robert Newman in Edinburgh, I think it was in 2000, doing a show which was actually an hour and a half of sort of journalistic, crusading, political comedy with 10 minutes of Jarvis in the middle just to break it up. And it was that was, yeah, an inspirational moment where I was doing the Comedy Zone late night package show, doing 20 minutes every night and struggling, to be honest. Yeah, I'd been doing the open mic circuit for about a year and a half, and I didn't quite have all the gears required to get through a late night package show in Edinburgh. So it was a bit up and down, and I was, you know, wasn't, I can't remember specifically what I was doing, but it was a little quirky, a little surreal. But and I sort of wanted to do politics, but I don't think I had the courage to do it at that point. And then seeing Rob Newman do, you know, just an hour and a half of just unapologetic, uncompromising political stand-up was that was quite an inspirational moment for me, and it made me think I needed to try quite a lot harder.
That's great. I love Edinburgh is perfect for that because it's so eye-opening. It's like the whole world, I think we've discussed with a few comics, in a month, and every emotion that you could ever have or ever do. But also getting a go at the Comedy Zone, that's sort of quite a big deal because it was a showcase, wasn't it?
Yes.
So people, you would get industry people. Do you remember who you were on with?
I was on with Danny Boy. Who's a great friend of mine, and we'd done quite a few student gigs before that. Spencer Brown, who I'd also known for a bit, and Karen Taylor, and we were all quite new. And Danny Boy was considerably better than the rest of us, and just a kind of natural performer. And he started off with him as the MC, and he was kind of slightly too good to be.
Well, he's in Scotland as well, so he is playing to a home crowd a bit as well, and give you guys the benefit of the doubt.
He was one of these comedians who almost emerged almost fully formed. He was brilliant as a new act, so it was really hard for the rest of us to follow him. So I ended up emceeing quite a lot, and he would go on at the end. But it was, yeah, it was a pretty tough experience. Also, yeah, my girlfriend, now wife, was away in traveling in China, so I didn't really have any kind of support network to see me through the difficult times. And yeah, there were some pretty rough gigs, and also some pretty rough reviews, including the very first week. I think our first day there on the Wednesday of the preview night, we got reviewed by The Observer, and the part of the review that dealt with me was two words long, and those two words were grindingly mediocre. So that was and I hadn't seen that until I can't remember. Someone told me about
someone
it.
Someone didn't say, no, yes. Not at the Fringe.
Yes.
Oh, what a beast.
Yes. So that was.
Can I just say to the listeners, that is absolutely verboten. You do not do that. One of the sort of unspoken rules of Edinburgh is if you've seen someone's bad review, you don't mention it to them. And some people are very, very good at going, I'm just not reading reviews at all. And you might be able to say to someone, because even saying to someone, you're having a great run, they'll be like, am I? I'm not looking at anything. Ah, don't get in my head. So like the idea that someone would tell you that it said that. And also, you know, later on, I was going to ask you how you deal with criticism, and we will come back to it. But the fact that you remembered that, those two, what was it, your first review?
Yes, I think I'd had a review in a student paper before, but that was my first. And it was in, you know, a national Sunday newspaper. Right. So that was. But yeah, it is part of learning the craft of stand-up, I guess, and it's to deal with
baptism of fire, Andy. That
the nature of stand-up is you sort of get reviewed every time you tell a joke or, you know, do a bit of material. There's an instant feedback, and you can sort of tell. So, but having that in print in my first, I think it was on day three of my first Fringe, was that was. Yes, chastening, I guess.
So you got that review. What sort of happened around that? Did you think, I can't get up again and go up again? Or were you like, I've just got to keep getting better? Was it fuel for you, or was it disheartening?
Well, I don't know. I'm can't quite remember how I dealt with it at the time. I think because they're just gigs you have to do every night that you don't get to
opt out. Yes, that's the thing.
Try and ignore it. And you know, probably had the arrogance of a young comedian to think, well, they're wrong.
Yeah.
But it did make me. It wasn't just it wasn't so much the reviews as the reaction I was getting, which was very mixed. And I was I did start emceeing more, and that made me slightly less tied to the material that I had, which in my first sort of few couple of years in comedy, I was just I had a script that I stuck to rigidly, so. It did make me think after over the course of that tough month, and also seeing these other shows, particularly that show that Rob Newman did. What am I doing? What kind of comedy do I actually want to do? Because I think in my first phase in stand up, like I guess like most people, I was doing anything to get a laugh, and
yeah.
I guess that Edinburgh, having a couple of bad reviews and quite a few bad gigs made me think. What is the purpose of what I'm doing? How can I, it seemed to me that I wasn't very good at that type of comedy and it wasn't really true to what I wanted to do. So by the time I went up the following year to do my first solo show, I changed pretty much everything about what I was doing.
This is quite interesting for people that sort of go to the fringe and watch comedy. How long was that before you did your first hour? Because this is something that seems to have changed as well. So you did sort of 20 minutes at the Comedy Zone.
Yeah.
But your first hour, how long had you actually been getting up on stage and doing stand-up before you did that?
Well, I did my first hour the following year, which was quite common at that point to do a package show 1 year and an hour the next year. And I don't know if it takes people a little longer then. It did cost me a ridiculous amount of money. But I was young and I needed not to have the money. Is that how the phrase goes? But,
yes, yeah.
My first Edinburgh was... My first full hour show was about 2.5 years after I started doing the open mic circuit in London. So I'd done a couple of circuits of the student tour. That was... a lot of... So my generation of stand-ups would do that. We'd go quite quickly into a first hour, and I think the process of putting together an hour that was just me, I think that does that. That was how I sort of started formulating what kind of comedian I wanted to be, and it clarifies the processes when you don't have to fit into a bill or you don't have to. Play to a certain assumed type of crowd. You can just do exactly what you want. There's no one else to blame or, take the credit for or whatever. It's all it's all you. And
I think I did 2009, so I'm thinking that might have been 4 years and maybe 3 years of doing straight stand-up as myself, not a character. I mean, it makes you exponentially better, right?
It definitely does. And, like I said, it makes you... think what am I doing as a comedian, and it's a hugely rewarding creative process, and I guess a lot of people we sort of get addicted to that process of trying to create a new show every year. And early in my career, like I said, Edinburgh, I viewed it sort of as a as we all do, it's part of your career plan, and you hope to get noticed or spotted in different ways. But after doing it 2 or 3 times and it's not really having particularly major effects in that. It just became something that I did because I loved doing it and to kind of create new material to build on new ideas and new skills. So, I did it for, I think, 11 years out of 12 before my children got to... Well, basically, once my children had reached school age and then... Edinburgh clashed with the school summer holidays and daddy going off to do a show for a month became quite antisocial. I've sort of cut back on the fringe since then.
And you do sort of shorter runs or every other year? And
yeah, I generally do 2 weeks rather than the full 4 week marathon.
the entire summer holidays. Because I think I saw your shows, at the Stand, tended to be where I'd seen. And there's an inventiveness to them. It was great coming to see one of your shows because it sort of taught me what's possible, because you would have props, you had the radio, you had little bits outside of the main narrative that were like pop up, almost like sketchified, these sort of ideas that I then guess that kind of surreal new spin that I then guess fed into the Bugle when you first started that.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So let's talk about how the Bugle came about, first of all. Like, because there's such a legacy in podcasting, I guess, in terms of what you were doing there, like the earliest sort of people that I can think of that were doing podcasts in the UK is sort of you and John doing the Bugle.
Yes. Well, to be honest, it wasn't a grand plan to think, oh, here's a new medium that can be really great for comedy. We should do something. We were offered a deal by the Times to do, I think it was 13 episodes, and they basically just gave us a blank canvas. But the idea was that, you know, it would have a sort of transatlantic feel to it, with John, who'd been doing The Daily Show for just over a year in America, and me in Britain. And obviously, because, you know, we'd worked together for years before John went to The Daily Show. We'd done live shows together. We did a couple of radio series together. That it was a really great thing to do, particularly for me, because, you know, he'd obviously was working on the world's leading satirical comedy show, but at that point there was not a great deal going on in my career, Tiff. But when John went to do The Daily Show in 2006, we'd been doing two series for Radio 4, which had both been cancelled, and we was just about to do a two-handed Edinburgh show at The Stand. And John was offered the Daily Show job, well, I don't know, it was a couple, 2 or 3 weeks before that? I can't quite remember. And also, we found out that my wife was pregnant. So it was all in the space of about 3 or 4 weeks. So it was a time of considerable upheaval. So the Bugle started the following year, and we were just offered a deal and to do this show, and had the idea of sort of forming it like an audio newspaper. And in fact, in the early days, it was more, I think we did it more in sort of sections like a Sunday newspaper. And it's become a little looser over the years. And the podcasting world was considerably smaller then, so it was, I think, easier to make a bit of an impact, particularly as, you know, John had already quite a profile in the States from The Daily Show, and we were hosted by The Times, which, so they paid us to do it so we could devote the time to doing it, and which was very rare in podcasting, I think, in those days, to be paid to do it. So we treated it like a radio show, and we would, you know, try and write a good show every week. And it and within, you know, a few weeks, even when, you know, we only had a few thousand listeners, I started to notice that people would come up at live shows and say, I've listened to your podcast, which, you know, I'd done quite a bit of Radio 4 stuff with much bigger audiences, and it never really
no one said that.
Well, it hadn't really translated into live audiences in the same way.
Right.
I think that's because people consume podcasts in a different way to radio, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's been so hugely successful as a medium, not just for comedy, but in, you know, in all, it's a very sort of personal medium, and people, if you start listening to it, you listen to it in a more committed way. You tend to be actively listening to it rather than the radio being on in the background. And you know, obviously now a lot of radio shows become, or are podcasted by the BBC and other people, that started to become more the case with radio as well. But at the time, it was clear quite early on to me that this was a really fantastic medium for comedy, not just because, you know, with audio you can be really creative quite easily. You can make things sound amazing in a way that making things look amazing on TV or you know, any kind of visual medium is a lot harder. And so it was a great blank canvas for us. The Times, you know, never interfered with what we were doing. And I think actually in time they probably forgot that we were still doing it because the person who commissioned it had moved on. So we had 4 years with them before they ushered us onwards. But yeah, that was, yeah, I mean, that slightly saved my career, to be honest, because I was going absolutely nowhere at the time. And I think my stand-up would probably stagnate. I think, you know, I've been working with John in doing live shows for 2 or 3 years, and for that to just, it just sort of ended abruptly because he got the job in the States. Yeah. And that left me slightly floundering around thinking, well, what do I do now? So the Bugle was...
your saviour.
It was, to a large extent, I think.
Yeah. Did you set out to make it as political and satirical? So you wanted to do an audio newspaper, but was that your intention? Did you sit down and kind of both of you go, right, we want it to do this, this and this, or we want it to speak truth to power, or we want to be silly, we want to, you know, did you sit down and kind of hash that out with each other?
Not really.
Or did it just form?
Not really. That was basically the way we'd done comedy together and individually, really, anyway. So it was really just, I guess, an expression of that. The radio series we did a thing called The Department on Radio 4 with Chris Addison that was, you know, a real mixture of politics and silliness. And, you know, in our live shows as well, we'd had, you know, we'd try to blend that. And I think that, you know, it's quite an effective way of doing political comedy if you leaven it with nonsense. Or, you know, you present a serious point in a ridiculous way. And, you know, you see that John has sort of carried that on through his stellar career in America. So, yeah, the Bugle was really... We'd both done, you know, topical political comedy for several years, so it sort of made sense to do that. And again, you know, if it was just banging on about politics for 40 minutes, it might get, I guess, a little heavy. So we always tried, and that was the nice thing about the format of it being loosely a newspaper meant that we could throw in, you know, sport and even a cryptic crossword in the early days. And I did one clue a week, long-term buglers may remember.
Some real long game happening, yeah, there, if you want to finish the podcast. Well, I got sort of two questions that have come out of that, but one I feel like might be better for the latter part of the podcast, so I'll save that. But you brought up Chris Addison. He's sort of in the Bugle fold quite recently. So it's kind of changed quite dramatically when you sort of brought it, when you were like, okay, let's change this. So can you tell me a bit about the thought process behind the roster of people that you have now and how that all came about?
Once John started doing Last Week Tonight, I mean, initially he thought he'd actually have a bit more time than when he was on The Daily Show, which was a sort of week-long job. But it became very clear that anchoring a show like that and being just totally committed to every stage of the creative process, that he just didn't have time to do a podcast every week as well. So, we came to an agreement that he'd stop doing it. And then I had to decide, do I try to keep this going? And if so, how?
Well, because you've created this audience of people who come to watch your live comedy because they listen so specifically. So it's, that must be a point for you again, where you were like, you were sort of floundering and then you had this thing.
Yes.
Were you like, oh God.
Yeah. Well,
I've got this great thing and is it going to disappear now?
Yes. So, I mean, that was definitely a fact. I mean, I absolutely love doing it, to have a weekly outlet for what, it, you know, with no sort of editorial oversight from anyone. It's all, you know, I could talk about whatever I wanted in whatever way I wanted. So, you know, that's almost the dream as a comedian. So, yeah, I decided that, you know, I wanted to carry it on. Also, as you said, we had a good and very loyal audience dotted around the world. So then I thought, well, how do I do this? Do I do I get, you know, one, try and find one other co-host? And I thought, you know, well, that's, I'd try to build up a stable of co-hosts. And initially there were, I think, four or five people that I asked to do it. And it worked all right for a bit. Obviously, I couldn't replicate the rapport I had with John, that even from the very first episode we did in on other side of the Atlantic, because we'd been friends and work colleagues and work, you know, creative partners for so long, it, it just sort of clicked straight away. And, you know, we have, you know, complementary styles. So that I couldn't recreate that with people that I didn't have that same kind of history with. Obviously, with, I had a different type of rapport with Helen, who was one of the early co-hosts, going back
the
to...
sibling rivalry.
Yeah, going back to when I first met her when she was about 24 hours old. So the moment I think it really started working better as a and became almost a new and slightly different show was when I went to the Melbourne Festival. And about 6 months after we'd relaunched and did a couple of shows there with two co-hosts. And that's the first time that Alice Fraser did it. And suddenly by having two rather than one co-host, you have instantly there was a much more dynamic conversation. And that, I guess, compensated for not having that that sort of rapport that I'd had with John. That, you know, it was starting to evolve with the co-hosts as I got to know them a bit better and, you know, work better with some than others. But then having two guests on a show just, I think, really brought it to life again.
Well, the response is not just hanging on one person
yeah.
constantly, so the three of you can throw the ball. And
yes.
and also, you know, when you're doing the show, from my point of view, I like I sort of know that you're going to do a couple of set pieces that I'm going to really love and be able to, you know, just different voices in the mix,
yeah.
which make it lovely. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yes. I just wanted to compliment you.
Thank you. So, yeah, so that's, I think, when it I started to think, oh, this you know, long term, this can become, you know, something new, but that's still discernibly... the, you know, I guess a descendant of the first phase of the Bugle, and it became a lot more fun to do as well. There was sort of slightly less pressure on me as host to drive everything if there was, you know, there were two guests rather than one. As I said, that, you know, the lines of communication were more interesting and dynamic when it's a triangle rather than a straight line.
Yeah. So, and that's when Nish came in.
Right. Well, Nish was in from the start. And it worked pretty well with him because he'd listened to the show for years. I knew him from the circuit as well, and we'd done shows together and already got on well.
Bugle super fan, Nish Kumar.
You know, enabled me to get more and more people involved and, you know, sort of build up that stable. So I think, yeah, that's when the, you know, the Bugle Mark II started really functioning well as a show.
I feel like it's got a quite in the original iteration you were sort of quite transatlantic, and now it's a bit more of a world view. You've got correspondence from sort of around the world, which I really like about the Bugle. I think it gives me a unique, when I'm listening, when I'm, you know, if I'm not in an episode and I listen to the episodes, that I can hear a perspective or something about a country that maybe I just didn't know so much about the politics about. So I think it's a really good entry into a country's politics when a Bugle's correspondence comes on. Does that sound like it's quite educational in a way?
Well, I'm not sure you should be relying on the Bugle for educational purposes, but I see what you're saying. And when I did it with John, we'd always, because, you know, we had the transatlantic side, but we'd always tried to cover stories from around the world as well. So, but, you know, having people from different places and in different places definitely enhanced that, I think. So that's always, you know, something that I've tried to make sure that it never becomes too focused on, well, either Britain or America. So having people from different countries definitely helps that.
And I would like to say you are great for getting different voices on as well, you know, and lots of women. That's one of the things about the Bugle that I really love. There's lots of female voices on it. And I just, I like to shout that out because it's rarer than you'd think that people actively go and seek out voices to kind of go, okay, well, I'm covering this sort of part, so who else can I get and bring into the mix? And so I would like to give a shout out to the Bugle for doing that.
Oh,
is that something you sort of actively set out to do, do you think? Or has it just been by accident you've kind of gone?
A bit of both, I think. I mean, I mean, in the initial rotation, I think Helen was the only woman that I had in it. But I think when I started to really think about who I wanted to get on it, I thought, you know, comedy has always been too male, essentially. So, yeah, it just made sense. And, you know, there's so many... I mean, I try not to think too much about having to cover various bases. I just try to get funny people on. But at the same time, I think, well, I want to, you know, a range of voices, a range of opinions, of perspectives. And obviously having more women helps that. And you know, there's lots of very funny women around that certainly in you know, the way comedy has often been done, don't always have that platform.
Here's a question I wanted to ask. It sort of came up as you were talking about it. How do you keep your sense of kind of like silliness when the world is crumbling around you? When it's like in the past few years, it's felt like politically a lot of huge stuff happening. And I know there's always stuff happening, but, you know, in the wake of Trump and Brexit and everything, how do you keep that silliness when it seems like everything is bleak?
Well, it can be quite hard, but at the same time, that if without it, things almost become worse.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, just from a personal point of view, it's, I guess, my comic style has always had that element to it because I don't really have the persona or really the life experience to just rant about stuff. It doesn't suit me and I'm not very good at it. So the absurdity was always a part of the way I did, the way I've done political comedy. And, you know, I think it's a way, like sort of hinted at before, of presenting or talking about really difficult, often quite depressing issues in a more kind of acceptable and accessible way is to just lighten it with that, you know, absurdity or, you know, bits of surrealism or really just bringing enough comedic inventiveness to it that it doesn't stray into just sort of opinion or journalism. By just keeping trying to make sure that there's enough light in the content that it that enables me to address, you know, big and quite often complicated, difficult, upsetting, depressing political issues, particularly if depending on your political persuasion. Yeah, so I guess that's I mean, and also, like I said, it's the way that I've largely done comedy anyway, is to have quite a lot of silliness involved.
I was asking earlier how you sort of felt about criticism, and equally, how do you deal with praise? Because I've given you a couple of compliments and you've just run away from them a bit. Is that how you?
All right.
Well, no, but you know, it's very British, isn't it, as well, I think, to bat back. I kind of like that about us, I've got to say, to kind of go, piece of shit, you know, when someone pays you a compliment. But how do you handle praise?
I don't know, I've not really thought about that. I mean, I guess going back to reviews early on in Edinburgh, where that's sort of the first place that as a comedian anyone bothers reviewing you, and no one notices apart from other comedians really. But I found that so the following year after I did the Comedy Zone, did my first Edinburgh show, that went very well, objectively, in pretty much everything apart from ticket sales. And I got a load of good reviews. They all came out in the last week, just late enough not to impact.
Bums on seats.
Overall income and bums on seats. But I found that sort of waiting for them and reading papers and reading other people's reviews just sort of played with my mind in a way that was not helpful. And so basically from that year on, I didn't really bother reading anything. And I found I didn't really have the mental strength not to be affected by reviews either way, whether they were good or bad.
Right.
But I did have the mental strength to just avoid them completely, which is a much lower level of mental strength. But it actually kind of just simplifies the whole process. I think having had not just reviews, but yeah, so I had some bad reviews and some good reviews in the first kind of the formative years of my career. And in terms of gigs, I always had a, particularly in sort of club gigs, weekend club nights, doing 20-minute sets, whatever, I always had a very mixed record. There were times when I'd go really well and times when I'd go really badly. So, you know, that mixture of success and failure, if you let either one affect you too much, then it's going to have an adverse effect.
Right. So you have to go the, I think the Myron...
kind of stoic approach.
Stoic, yeah, yeah.
Yes. I love a bit of ancient stoicism.
I was going to say Maya Angelou, I don't pick it up, I don't lay it down, which is, yeah, you know, good or bad, is to try not to let them affect you.
And also, you know, having been doing anything long enough, but particularly comedy, which has that instant response from an audience, you sort of know when something's good and when something's not. And so hopefully after a few years and a few good and bad experiences with feedback of different kinds, you know, I learned to manage my own reaction to my own work.
So one of your processes that kind of reveals... does reveal to me one of your processes, that criticism and praise, you kind of go, don't engage with it because you can't keep it out. You can't not let it affect what you're doing.
Yes.
Can you look at stuff after it when you've got some distance from it? When you've finished a show, when you finished a tour, when you've...
Yes, I think that can help. So if there's a common thread in a number of different reviews, it can be quite helpful to pick up on. But I think, you know, generally, once you've been doing stand-up for a few years, you ought to be able to sort of work out yourself what needs improving.
Yes. So. Yeah. Mine's always editing. Always editing. Just stop trying to cram too much. Leave them wanting more, Paul says to me every year.
Yeah, no, that's nonsense. Always leave them wanting slightly less.
So what are your personal tiny revolutions, things that have made a difference to you in your daily life? And by that, I mean kind of like often in terms of creativity, we talk about morning routines. So like Hemingway would go for a walk, or someone might say, oh, I do morning pages. I sit down and I... But what about the rest of the day? Because comedians work at night. So I'm always like, what do you do? Do you meditate? Do you have processes? Do you do things to get you into a space of creativity?
I've never really had anything resembling a reliable process. And the one thing that gets me writing and creating essentially is a deadline, whether that's having to do a new Edinburgh show or with the Bugle having a show every week, which has been one of the many great things for me personally about doing the Bugle, is it's sort of forced me into a routine where I have to create something new every week that, you know, without that structure, I'm not sure I'd have the discipline to do. So I'm not sure I really have anything other than, I mean, the pressure of time does generally get the creative juices flowing. I mean, there's a couple of little things. I find doing cryptic crosswords gets my mind thinking laterally in a way that is really good for then trying to write comedy.
I think I remember you saying this once before, and I think that's a really great tip. That's a really great, yeah, just thinking about stuff in a slightly different way.
Yes, so that's something I do quite a lot now. But no, in terms of a routine or a discipline or some kind of insightful life hack, I'm afraid I've never quite come across that.
Not got there. Not no walking or no. I tend to find, and I'm happy now that we've eased the lockdown a bit, I'm sort of energized when I'm around people, and it doesn't necessarily have to be people that I'm engaging with, but I like to go to a cafe and then take out my notebook and hear people have all of that hum and notice, maybe hear bits of what people are talking about or see a thing that makes me go, oh God, you know, that I've got to sometimes, you know, and that's one of the things about comedy. I think rage can be a starting point a lot of the time. So I've got to try and sort of climb down from rage into something that's funny, from something that's annoyed me or made me furious, to then find the way into that? Do you start with something that makes you angry or a political injustice, or are you, you know, something that you look at and you go, oh God, that's just so insane. Like, I'm going to write about that. What's the, how does that work for you?
Well, again, a lot of it just comes down to having a weekly deadline. So, you know, when I read or watch the news, I'm generally thinking, oh, is this something that we can talk about in the Bugle, or now I'm doing the news quiz on Radio 4. Is this a story that would be good to do on that? And then the task is, you know, how can I address that in an interesting way? But yeah, again, without the deadline of a weekly podcast, I don't know quite how I'd go about it. I've been doing the Bugle for so long now that it's just, that's sort of the main driver of my creativity. And a lot of what I do in stand-up, the one I do an Edinburgh show, I'll often pick up an idea that I've written for the Bugle, which is, the Bugle is almost kind of first draft a lot of the time. I write quite quickly to that deadline. And quite early on when I was doing it with John, I just wrote in almost an improvisational way where I try and think the first idea and just write it out and see what comes out. Then often I'll develop those ideas for stand-up subsequently. But, you know, without that weekly outlet and deadline as what mostly motivates my creativity.
Are there ever stories that you look at or stuff that you go, I can't find the funny in this anymore. I think I've spoken about it in every way it's possible to talk about this thing now. Or is that a challenge to you? Do you like that challenge of going, what else can I find in this terrain?
There are definitely stories like that. I mean, I think COVID has become like that, that it's, we're now in a sort of seemingly endless cycle of repeating elements of the story and the politics over and over again in sort of cycles of varying lengths. And with, you know, Brexit as an issue became comedically quite tiresome. and Trump as well. And Trump was an interesting challenge for comedians because, you know, in the age of sort of internet comedy, and the, you know, ubiquity of all kinds of topical comedy, the challenge to try to address Trump as a comedian was to find some way of dealing with it that hadn't already been done, and that I think became harder and harder. And you know, he was, although, you know, what he did varied, it was essentially, you know, the same satirically. It was almost the same thing for 4 years. I did this thing in my live show where I printed out his brain.
Do you remember this?
So it was and it came out
cauliflower
that I put on a microphone stand and stuck an electrode in it. Well, some kind of prong, and then a chopped up Trump speaking, and then made him talk about cricket. And that was the lengths I had to go to have a way of dealing with Trump comedically that I was pretty sure no one else was doing, to have Donald Trump talking about 1920s Australian cricketers.
That is beautiful, because that perfectly sort of summarizes what you do to me. Yeah. Like, and you've had to bring him into one of your loves. You've had to bring cricket in to go, I've got, like, you know, almost making him not palatable, but like, how can I deal with this now? I'm so tired, because he became self-satirizing as well.
Yes.
We just, all of us, any of us that kind of deal in any kind of political comedy, we're like, we just can't keep doing the same stuff about him, because it's beyond parody. But it's interesting that you bring cricket up, because I do want to talk cricket a bit more. So your, like, kind of career in cricket has sort of run parallel with your career in comedy, or comedy got you into, like, doing some cricket commentary first? Is that how that worked?
Yeah, I mean, again, that came from the Bugle, that I talked about cricket quite a bit in the Bugle, and it always had this element where a lot of our audience was American, so, you know, I would criticise them for not adopting cricket as their national sport when they had the chance. And someone who worked at the Crickinfo website, a chap called Will Luke, used to listen to the Bugle, and he just emailed me and said, would you like to write for us? And so the cricket was a lifelong obsession from when I was sort of 6 or 7 years old. And I'd always loved it. And like I said, I wanted to get into, I wanted to be a cricket journalist essentially when I was a kid. In fact, when I started doing the open mic circuit, in that period where I had a job as a sub-editor at a publishing house, I applied for a job at the Cricketer magazine and got to the last two, but then didn't get the job. And had I done that, I don't know if I would have done comedy.
Right.
And I don't know if I would have enjoyed that job. It was based in a small porter cabin about a mile from where my parents lived in Tunbridge Wells. And I'm not sure that would have been ideal in my mid-20s to be moving back home. So, so then I started writing in 2008 for Crick Info and started writing about cricket stats because... basically they wanted a funny column every week, and I thought there's only so many funny things that I could say about cricket, so I found, you know, I always knew quite a lot about the stats, and they had this stats engine on their website, and I started playing with that, and that sort of became my angle, was cricket stats with a bit of humour. And then I wrote for them for 8 or 9 years, and then via that then got into the radio commentary, which I started doing 5 years ago, and that was, you know, genuinely a childhood dream of mine that I used to listen.
I was going to say a dream come true, yeah.
It was properly that, you know, I used to listen to the radio, and they had a chap called Bill Frindle, the bearded wonder, would do the stats, and I used to think, God, I'd love to do that. And that is now a large part of my life. So it's every day that I'm on, I still can't quite believe I get paid to watch cricket, but every day that I'm on Test Match Special, I try to take a few moments to just appreciate how incredible it is that I'm basically paid to indulge my lifelong obsession.
If I wanted to talk in a sort of, in self-help language, that's acknowledging presence, gratitude.
Okay. Yes.
Presence. So in the moment of kind of going, which is something worth, you know, trying to do, just consciously kind of going, I'm doing this.
Yes. Well, I try to do that in stand-up as well, particularly, you know, doing a solo show and you've got an hour, or on a tour show might have, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours. To just, there's moments, particularly when it's going really well, where you can slightly step back and think, oh, this, what an amazing thing to be doing this is. And it's very, very rewarding like that.
Is there a cricketer that you look at and you think, I could draw, I mean, this is a left field question, but that's the closest, like, career parallels I could draw to me, someone whose journey in cricket has been similar to your journey in
comedy. Don't know, actually,
because I think a bit of a late bloomer, because I look at the news quiz and I think, wow, you know, like, that is such a perfect, you almost like you created a new genre and way of doing this thing, but of course that's the perfect, like, you know. So I think of you a bit as a late bloomer.
Yeah, I think that's right, or at least, you know, I guess that level of success that I have had, particularly in the last few years with Test Match Special and the News Quiz, did come after pretty much 20 years. So I was always sort of successful enough to keep going without ever... And, you know, the Bugle was, I think, very successful for what it is. But it was a kind of gradual process, and then I sort of had these sort of lucky breaks in the last couple of years that have... built on that. So I don't know who I'd compare that with in cricketing terms. I guess someone who doesn't play for their national test team until they're 30 odd and then has a few good years. But hopefully those few good years will last quite a long time.
Who would that be? Is there someone? That someone?
I guess Andrew Strauss didn't play for England until he was 20. Some Graham Swan came in 28, 29. They had very good careers. But I do think there are quite a lot of parallels between cricket and stand-up, particularly batting and stand-up. That if you're into cricket, you sort of see these things of that, you know, mixture of, you know, success and failure, that sometimes nothing to do with you, sometimes it's your own fault, sometimes you get lucky, sometimes you don't. And, you know, particularly with club gigs, there's times where, you know, as a batsman in a difficult situation, you might have to defend a bit and then it gets easier. And the same with a difficult gig, you might just see off the first few minutes and then you can expand. Other times it's just clicks right from the start. So there's elements of similar. As a repressed cricketer, I'm an international cricketer trapped in an incompetent village cricketer's body. So stand up was sort of the closest I could get to living out my dreams of being an international athlete.
I would buy a book how to be a comedian or the life of a comedian through the eyes of cricket. So right. I'm hoping you're going to do that.
I might well write that at some point, Tiff.
Yeah, I think you should. I think you should. So I think cricket is a perfect way to... I can't think of a better way to end a conversation. Tiny revolutions. Because cricket has been so revolutionary to you and fulfilling that dream, I think that's a beautiful way to end the podcast. Thanks for coming on Tiny Revolutions. Thanks for making Tiny Revolutions, should I say, a Bugle production.
Nice to have you in the stable, Tiff.
Yes, I love it. What a great stable to be in. I feel like a thoroughbred. thank you for coming on Tiny Revolutions. This has been Andy Zaltzman. Thank you so much, Andy, for sharing with us your Tiny Revolutions.
You can listen to other programmes from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.